are now tuned in to the Wisco Weekly Experience.
Chicken brown, cow. Listeners, welcome to another episode of Wisco Weekly. I'm your host, Dennis Wisco, alongside co-host
Kelly Cruz.
Kelly, and here we are with yet another episode, and there's been some interesting developments going on in the automotive world, one of which I wanted to bring to your attention. So AAA did a study through Your Driving Costs is the title of the study. So guess how many miles an average driver drives in a year? And this would be in an urban area. How many miles does the average driver drive in an urban area?
I'm going to go with 11,000.
Ooh, survey says close enough. 10,841 miles per year.
Do I lose for going over?
You do. This is The Price is Right.
Darn it.
And I know you know that game. So here's another question here for you. How much annually does an urban driver spend on ride-hailing services?
Someone who owns a car but also uses ride-hailing services?
Good question. It would be if they were using ride-hailing as a primary mode of transportation.
And I'm sorry, you said how much, monthly or annually?
Annually.
Annually. Ooh, that's a tough one.
And again, like imagine, like this doesn't really apply to us in Orange County, but if you're in LA, Chicago, New York, Boston, these kind of...
$8,000.
Incorrect. You want to give it one more go? It's higher than that.
$15,000.
Closer. $20,000. $20,118 to be exact, according to the study. So if you were living in one of these urban areas and you were relying solely on ride-hailing services, you'd spend about $20,118.
It's pretty pricey.
How much are you spending on childcare a month?
Per month, about $2,600.
So that would be interesting. I wonder what the study would be if they would combine, like, you know, if families are included into the study, so that it's like, okay, not only are you ride hailing yourself around or you're transporting yourself around, but you have to go take kids to, you know, you're not walking them to school, you're driving them to school. If you're driving, what do you think about a mother who would take an Uber to drop their kid off at school?
As long as there's a car seat.
I guess so. Okay, last question here is what would be the average cost to own a vehicle, and for the average annual cost to own and operate a new vehicle, and this would be over the course of 1 year, and given that the average amount of miles is 10,841 miles, so what would be the average cost to own a new vehicle per year?
Own between the cost of the car, but also operation expenses?
Yeah, so things that would be considered would be the depreciation, maintenance, fuel, financing, insurance, DMV costs. So what would that annual cost be over a period of, again, 10,000 miles?
Let's go with $10,000.
You are definitely a Price is Right girl. That's a little bit above. It's actually $7,321. But again, that's the average number. So I imagine if you're driving a Prius versus a Ford F-150, right? Your average would be $7,321. Now, you know what's actually not is that $7,321 annual cost to own. I wonder if. I guess it's what's not stated in there is I wonder, like, things like car washing or electricity from your garage, just like the lights and the operation. I know it's minor, but, you know, whatever.
All things included.
Yeah, all things included. But it is interesting to kind of hear some of these stats about these, not so much the average miles per year. I think that's pretty much been a given. Also, the average annual cost to own a car, that's pretty much a given. But the ride hailing, since that's such a new thing going on in the automotive world, And, you know, again, a ride-hailing service, if you're using that as your primary mode of transportation, it would cost $20,118.
Higher than I would have expected.
A lot higher. I mean, that's, mm-hmm. I mean, if anything, you probably don't even realize how much, you know, it's like, well, they say here too, every trip averages out to be $13. And like, again, $13, well, of course, that's nothing, right? That's like a lunch now. And like every time you do it, it's like, okay, that's not a problem. $13, right? But in a larger aspect where this is all going, Kel, is that there's certainly this bigger movement that supersedes everything that we're doing here in the automotive world, where the automotive world can be kind of defined as automakers, dealers, you know, that kind of traditional industries and companies. And then you have transportation / mobility. So this is like, these are now the tech companies that are coming in. These are like, you know, government officials and whatnot. Well, there's a conference coming up at the end of November called Automobility LA. I believe it's actually one of the premier conferences that discusses transportation and mobility, connected cars, autonomous vehicles, things of that nature. Telematics, my new favorite thing.
Mm-hmm. Where is it held?
It's held in Los Angeles at the Convention Center, and it precedes the LA Auto Show. Okay. So the reason why I bring this up to you, Kel, is that we are going to be doing some special things as we gear up for that conference. One of the things is we are going to be welcoming a new contributor to the show. He's going to be our automation contributor. He is also the host of his own podcast show called Boost Booze BBQ. And he hails from Portland, Oregon. He works in industrial design by day and by night. He's a big car guy, so he's trying to always find his next project car. So I do want to welcome to the show our new automation contributor, Andy Ace. So Andy, welcome to Wisco Weekly. Please tell me and Kelly and our listeners a little bit about yourself.
Well, I love sleepers. That's kind of the thing about me. Almost every race car I've had has been not the most ideal race car, but it's been something that no one has expected. The latest car that I just got rid of here a little bit ago was a 1991 Mazda Protege that was all-wheel drive. It had the all-wheel drive system out of a 323 GTR and big turbo standalone engine management system, all tech, you know, wait, all the normal goodies.
Wait, did you have it stock or did you say you modified it?
No, it was heavily modified. It made 360 all-wheel horsepower.
Okay.
Yeah, and it was a ton of fun, and I've had a bunch of different cars. I had a Turbo Festiva for a little while.
Nice.
I would be more than happy to supply you with the photos, because I say that to a lot of people, and they go, Turbo Festiva? No, there's no way, I don't believe it. Yeah, sad but true. That was a great, fun little car. You know, that's what got me into industrial design, and once upon a time, I thought I was going to be an architect, but here I am working for an automation group here in Oregon, and loving every minute of it. I find it very interesting. Cars are still very much my passion. Podcasting is still very much my passion, but I find it very interesting, the melding of the automotive world and the automation world right now.
Speak on that some more. You know, we were talking previously of there's kind of like this shift in the paradigm of what, you know, car enthusiasts versus people who, you know, appreciate transportation. You know, there's kind of this line in the sand. What were your thoughts on that?
The lines are getting muddy. The waters are getting muddy, in my opinion. We have people who still want to drive their cars and still want to have that experience and still want to feel very connected to the road. And then we have other people who are looking for the automation in the vehicles. And the more we get these vehicles that are really trying to mesh the two, I think that instead of meshing the two, we are going to find that it more punctuates that there are two different types of people in the world. You and I were talking off air about the different concept vehicles that have been coming out and how they're all ugly and they're all these big bubbles, and they're building them not like cars, but like family rooms. You know, the seats, instead of being captain's chairs, they're sofas and recliners, and no one that I know who's a car person that drives for the enjoyment of driving is going to want a vehicle like that. But the people that I know who really don't like driving and see it strictly as a chore, they would love a car like that. And so I feel like at some point we are going to see those two sides getting polarized. And I'm hoping that car manufacturers don't find themselves in a situation where they focused too much on one or the other.
Well, this is all going to be part of having Andy on the show here. And as we talk about the future of automotive and, you know, how not only from the technology side of things, but from the automakers, some of the different products that they're coming out with to not just combat the change, but, you know, they're starting to align with this change. Now, Andy, you do have some news for us here. Why don't you share with us some of the things that are going on in the automation field of automotive?
Well, one of the most recent things that has happened is Waymo had a valuation from Morgan Stanley come through. And I hope you're sitting down, Dennis. Morgan Stanley is valuing Waymo, the subsidiary of Alphabet, also the parent company of Google, at $175 billion, and that is with a B, billion dollars. The smallest chunk.
Did they say what that's attributed to at all?
Yeah, the attribution of that is the robo-taxi service. They're estimating that the business model for that automated taxi service is worth somewhere between $50 and $60 billion. The smallest chunk of the valuation right now is actually from the licensing of their software, because all of these larger companies like GM, Ford, not Toyota so much because they have their own systems happening right now, but possibly as Waymo continues to make advancements beyond where Toyota or Honda or, dare I say, even Tesla are right now. As they continue to make those advancements, their software and their hardware, like the new LiDAR systems, it's not a radar, but it's a laser range system that Waymo is using. Those are going to be worth a lot of money. And once they hold those patents, the other companies are going to want to get in on that.
Wow. That is impressive that Waymo in a very short time has been able to build up these kinds of relationships and get valued at $175 billion. I guess only time will tell to see if that valuation is indeed correct. Of course, that's a large amount, but I wouldn't put it past Google and in general, the automotive industry. I mean, this is a huge industry that has worldwide implications. So, I mean, who knows? Maybe in about 5 years, 7 years, that number may look a lot more, feasible than it does right now.
Well, that's right. And like you said, everybody is just kind of waiting to see what's coming next. GM doesn't have plans for really heavily implementing automation into their vehicles until 2019. And Ford is actually out further than that. They're looking at 2021. So everyone's just kind of sitting and waiting to see how this whole thing turns out, whether or not Waymo can figure out how to get their cars to merge or how to get them to turn left.
All right. Well, so that's Waymo. How else are we looking in the automation field right now?
You know, it's like I said about the concept vehicles. BMW just unveiled their Vision iNext concept, and BMW is calling it the ultimate self-driving machine, a little play on their ultimate driving machine. And I got to tell you, it's just leaving me wanting. You know, it doesn't, not only does it not look like a BMW, it looks like your grandmother's living room inside. I mean, it doesn't have captain's chairs or bucket seats. It's got sofas and recliners. I'm not into it. And the more that I see vehicles like this that just looked like a bubble top Jetson mobile, the more I start feeling like, you know, that's it's like you said before, there's going to be a line drawn in the sand, and you're going to have to decide which side that you're standing on. And some of these larger companies like BMW, I could definitely see them having a fully automated, full self-driving vehicle for the one side, and then their M3 or their M5 or their M2 or even their 1M on the other side, you know, and keeping those two separate. That, in my opinion, is going to be an important thing. And, you know, the thing that I feel like people have not addressed very well so far is the topic of car sickness with all of these self-driving vehicles. I don't know if you're like me, but I do get car sick, which is weird because I have a Rose Cup. I've been racing for years, but when I'm in the passenger seat of a car and I'm looking down at a phone or a book or anything like that, I do tend to get car sick. And recent studies have found that at least 12% of the population get car sick. And so trying to find a way to help people not be car sick in these self-driving vehicles, I think is going to be a big one. There's a research team at UMTRI that patented a solution earlier in the year where they used lights inside of the cabin to signal to the passengers when a turn or a stop might be coming up. And so they could kind of mentally prepare themselves, you know, to be able to react as the self-driving vehicle is stopping or turning. They won't have their body thrown, and then it can, in theory, help reduce the impacts of the car sickness.
Man, this is almost like a brand new undiscovered field that will come about in the automotive industry or in the field of automation, and that being like this fusion of neuroscience and, you know, human psychology, where now, just like you said, if you're able now to somehow manage the dizziness through light sensors in a vehicle, I mean, now you're certainly toying around with brain stimulation and chemistries and playing around with dopamine effects and whatnot to, you know, be able to balance out things as simple as, you know, getting dizzy in a car. I mean, kind of like you said earlier, right? It's all these like little problems that take complex solutions to try to figure out. And this is an interesting one to deploy lights as a way to manage dizziness in a car. Because yes, I do get dizzy in a car. And especially if these are driverless cars where people are encouraged to just sit back and relax and, you know, more than likely read on their phone or, you know, read something, listen to music. They're definitely not paying attention. Then you can have that sense of disequilibrium, which causes that dizziness. So that's interesting, Ace Man.
Well, and when you're an automotive manufacturer, if you're looking at a bottom number of 12%, I mean, these studies say at least 12% of the population of not just the country, but the planet get car sickness. That is a huge, huge number that you need to take into consideration.
I like it. I think you and I should start our new pharma auto company.
That's right. We'll have the seasickness dispensers that we start putting in the driverless Ubers, right?
I dig it.
You know, that's what I love about you, Dennis, because you are all about the customer experience, and that's what I dig about you.
Well, I appreciate that, Andy, and I am looking forward to having you as a regular on the show to talk about all things going on with automation. So, listeners, be sure you check out the episode page. I'll put some of his contact information so you can start to follow Andy, but expect to hear and see more of Andy on Wisco Weekly. So, Andy, we'll be in touch soon. We'll be in touch soon, sir.
That sounds great. Thank you, Dennis.
I'm excited to have Andy as part of our show. In Los Angeles, a triple threat is known as someone that can sing, dance, and act. But here we have Andy. In the automotive world, a triple threat is someone that knows about cars, podcasts, and automation. Welcome, Andy.
Yes, yeah, sing his praises, girl. All right, well, Kelly, we're going to take some calls right now.
Hello.
Hi, Doris.
Hi.
Hi, this is Kelly and Dennis calling from Wisco Weekly. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing well, thanks. So we heard you had a question. How can we help?
Yes, I do. So I have a younger daughter who is 15 and a half and very interested in cars. She has been for the last few years, where she could pretty much name any car that were to drive by, usually higher end cars, tell you what make, model, etc. on it. Just has this love and passion for nice cars and super intuitive and detail oriented. And it's been this way. And we're now starting to think about college in the next few years. And she wanted to do something or major in something that was car related without it being like design or car sales. But I was just curious what she could pursue in college that would help her go into the automotive industry in some kind of capacity.
Out of curiosity, who does she get her, where does her interest in cars come from?
No, probably from her parents. both my husband and I are very interested in cars. I love their intricacies and their detail. And my husband has always liked nice cars as well. So she probably gets it from us, her older sister who just left for college, who is going into nursing, likes cars, but doesn't have the passion that Olivia has.
Let me ask you this, and this is going to be a little more of a blunt question here. Obviously, you're the
No problem. I'm a blunt person.
Okay, you're obviously the parent, the mother here, and you know if we're talking about academic wise for your daughter, is she mm-hmm. a pretty academic mm-hmm. person, or is she kind of more of a feeler? Let's go with the flow. Let me experience it, and then after that, she can kind of use her intuition and instincts.
Book smart or street smart.
Yeah, basically.
Well, that's interesting. I would say in that aspect, both of my girls are street smart and book smart, but not book smart. Not crazy book smart. Like my older daughter who just graduated, she slid in to be a valedictorian and she had a 4.05 for her 4 years. And that to me is something I never accomplished. And unfortunately, she made valedictorian, but in her high school, there were a lot of students that were like 4.3, 4.4. I mean, it's just, that's the way of life right now. And her sister is not a 4.0, but I would say high 3. So she's academic, not crazy academic, and not, it doesn't come easy to either of my girls, but they both have street smarts with that academia. That's something that we have pushed as parents because you have to be well-rounded.
Okay, so
She has both.
Okay, so this is what I think would be potentially good for Olivia. Olivia's the youngest daughter, yes?
Correct. Yes.
Okay, so she's a sophomore in high school.
In high school, correct.
And I take it not only from her end, but for you guys, college is definitely a must, or it's going to happen.
Must. Like
So
4 year college.
Okay. So one of the things that and it's not that even I believe, like one of the things that you are starting to see in the automotive industry that is becoming very, very apparent is the kind of transition of cars going from this mechanical experience to this whole technological experience. And I think especially the fact that she's young and I'm sure she's very savvy on technology, I think one of the areas that you'll start to see a lot of growth in, especially at the time that she's probably in college and probably when she gets out of college, is just the whole idea of user experiencers. Okay. And the user experiences that I'm talking about are more with, okay, if she's driving in a car, how does she interact with the car? How does the car interact with the road? This is actually a specific field now in the automotive industry, and it's called telematics.
Okay.
So telematics is kind of a subset of computer technology where you're allowing the car to interact with the road. That interaction is producing data. You're having the driver interact with the car that's producing data. And then now it's a matter of who is best to understand the data to formulate new experiences. So again, this is kind of how Uber and Lyft was born. This is how autonomous cars were born, right? It's the idea of analyzing all this data. Now, that can be a very academic thing, okay? So of course, if she doesn't want to go the route of pursuing a master's and whatnot, on one hand, just to study that portion of telematics and to understand that is going to give her a leg up amongst other people who will be entering the car industry. And in general too, I would say that by having that kind of background, she can then start to apply for these internships that usually occur in the summertime with manufacturers. So again, this starts to get her into the game. It starts to give her the experience of progressing up the corporate ladder with these manufacturers and with these big tech companies too. Because again, you are having a lot of this overlap between Google and the automotive industry, Apple and the automotive industry. So this can really be a way for her to start, you know, being part of this growing generation of using technology to form what the future of the automotive industry is going to be.
Right. That's very interesting.
There's
what would she go after? Like, what would she go into college for? Like a degree in what?
So there's probably very little colleges that would offer a degree specifically in telematics.
Obviously, yes. That's why I'm asking. Yeah.
But the two areas that are a little bit more general would just be computer technology, information technology, okay. Or telecommunications. Now, if she is not in the technical realm.
Yeah, I would say she's more. And then when I think about the academic or street smart, I would say she's pretty street. She's compared to her sister, I would say. She might be more street smart than academic, but she's definitely very academic. But if you'd have to pick, she's probably more street smart. So I'm not sure IT would be her path. Very big people person, but I couldn't tie in people person and automotive in college.
Yeah,
that's where I was having trouble.
Well, so there's another area that I would, another major, if you will, that she can get into. Now, mind you, too, in terms of getting into computer technology or telecommunications, this is just to have that background because what she'll come to find out that as she starts working for perhaps these automotive manufacturers that, you know, she's going to wear many different hats, right? But the advantage she's going to have is this knowledge of telematics that a lot of people will just probably not have at that time. So it's really to gain that foundation. The other area that could, you know, how is she in terms of an arguer?
Very good.
Okay, so
she's a teenager, Dennis.
Yes. Well, so then the other thing then I would add is, you know, have her start looking into the field of law. Because not only now can she get the background of policies and regulations, but it's going to help her with the communication that she will ultimately need at the highest levels to be in automotive. It's certainly one of the things, and so Well, one of the things that's definitely going to be needed, if not now, then definitely sooner than later, is going to be women influencers. And so if she's able to have that, those communication skills where there's a background in something other than automotive, because again, there's just not a lot of schools that offer automotive training.
I know,
right?
I know. That's why I was lost. Yeah.
Yeah. So then it's nice to have these transferable skills or a background in law or a background in computer technology that will ultimately, you know, catapult her to another level, to areas where most of her other, colleagues and coworkers have probably studied communications or social sciences or things that they didn't learn anything out of it.
What about like a business route?
I wouldn't recommend the business route. At least as an undergrad, maybe as a master's, yes, but not as an undergrad. I do think that in terms of the automotive industry, having having a computer or engineering background, I think those are the things that will help the most in the future. There's just so much change going on that you kind of need to have the basic fundamentals of, you know, how does this technology work? And if you don't have that, then I don't want to say you're going to be stuck in a marketing job and to not give credence to marketing, right? But certainly there are other positions to aspire to.
Mm-hmm. I like the pre-law. I like the pre-law idea.
Now, you said that she wouldn't work in a dealership, or she doesn't want to do the car sales route kind of thing.
Yeah, that's me talking.
Okay.
You know what? She'd probably be a good, I don't know. She can do more than that, but I don't know. I mean, maybe, I don't know.
Well, we'll put you this way though, too.
I mean, I don't want her to go to college and have her be a car salesman.
Yeah. I mean, put you this way, the retail operation of the car business is changing dramatically. And, you know, especially if she's good at managing, you know, managing people, managing mm-hmm. things, and mm-hmm. that, and she, if she wants to make a lot of money, she would be very valued in the dealership world as a female and do really well if she were committed to it. You know, to that end, also, there's what's interesting is in November, towards the end of November, there's actually a conference called Women in Automotive. I don't think there's an age range at all, but it's in LA. It might be worth your time for you and Olivia to look that up and maybe attend it.
I'm just noting it down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Women in Automotive. It's going to be at, I think the Staples Center or Convention Center, mm-hmm. one of the two. It's towards the end of November. It's right before the LA Auto Show.
Okay.
So maybe check that out and maybe look to go. And if you do go, hopefully you can give us a report back.
That sounds great.
Yeah. So, well, is there anything else that we can answer for
No,
you?
No, that was a wealth of information. Thank you so much.
Okay. We'll talk to you soon. Thanks, Doris.
Thanks, Doris.
Well, so what did you think of women working in automotive, Cal? And especially an aspiring, let's call it a girl aspiring to be a woman in automotive.
Right. Well, one, I always love when there's passion. I think passion for anything is important. And the fact that a 15 and a half year old can have passion about something is pretty cool. And obviously she has parents who are supportive of, you know, whatever her career choice may be. And I think that if she starts young and gets experience and, like you said, takes a path in college that is different than what other people are doing who want to get into the industry, that she may find herself better off than maybe a man, because it's less common to see a woman in that space.
A woman working in automotive, first off, right? Like, and especially trying to escalate through the corporate ladder, it's a very tall order. I mean, you know, we talked about grit in the car business, right? Like, mm-hmm. there's going to be grit anytime you're going to be in a male dominated industry. I think I remember this when I interviewed a Finnish woman. There's a term in Finnish called sisu.
Okay.
Sisu is like the same as chutzpah. But sisu is the whole idea of, you know, just you can run through a wall, right? It's the picture I remember she painted for me was the whole idea of how, you know, saunas are really big in Finland. And so you go into a sauna, especially during the wintertime. And then as soon as you were done in the sauna, the next thing you know is then you're making a snow angel in the, you know, in the snow, or you're jumping in a cold lake. And like, that's kind of a regular thing people do in Finland as a way to demonstrate this idea of sisu.
Interesting. So is she trying to say that she was sisu, that like she could, you know, get through anything?
Yeah. Like, yeah, this Finnish woman was, and again, I think it's going to be indicative of, let's say, this girl here, Olivia, who, if she's going to work her way up, she's going to need that sisu kind of mentality. But, you know, working in a male-dominated industry, I have no idea what that's like, right? It's like most of the workforce is male-dominated, but you work in a male-dominated industry. Like, what is it like for you? I mean, are there injustices? Are you a victim? Or what's your take on working in a male-dominated industry?
Yeah, I was thinking about that as we were talking, because honestly, when I got out of law school, and I don't know that I would necessarily say the legal field is a male-dominated industry, but being in estate planning, when I got out of law school, it was certainly male-dominated, and older males. So coming out and going into meetings, it's having to establish your credibility as soon as you start the conversation, because otherwise people sit across the table and they expect a middle-aged male, not a young, you know, female. And
how are you establishing credibility? Or like, what does that mean exactly?
Right. So I think one, it's being personable, but right off the bat, letting them know that you have knowledge in the industry. And so to do it in a kind of tactful and skillful way, but to start the conversation, to explain to them what, you know, what I do, what my firm does, and then talk about the laws around estate planning and why we do certain types of planning and why you need different types of documents or tax laws that are related. And so by letting the person know that you have that wealth of knowledge, it establishes some credibility up front where they feel more comfortable.
So interesting. So your method of credibility is demonstrating knowledge. So therefore it gains the respect of everyone else in the room. I remember back in the day, I was probably in my mid-20s and I was working at UCI in the athletic department, and I was serving as the director of annual giving, and I was put in charge of a board of directors in which they were at least 15, 20 years older, way more zeros in their bank account than I had at that time. And, you know, C-level executives, right? And my way of demonstrating credibility was more in delegation. And it was funny because I will still remember till this day, you know, being in this boardroom of 20 other people. And again, everyone is 15 years my senior, few more zeros in their bank account than me. And I knew that going in. And so for me, I was like, okay, well, look, guys, this is how it's going to go.
Right.
You, sir, this is what you're doing. This is what you're in charge of. I need you to report back. And like, I don't know. That's kind of how I rolled.
I think
it actually worked out pretty well.
I think it's confidence. I think you're playing on, like you said, you're delegating, but you're also doing it with confidence and conviction. And so whereas if you kind of said, I don't really know what to do, and you're more iffy, then people trust in you less and necessarily don't believe what you say. So
there's two ways of
confidence,
at least two ways of going about it that you and I have both succeeded in both paths.
I'd like to think so.
Yeah. But okay, well, we'll be back right after this.
Hey, Wisco Weekly listeners, Automobility LA is coming up, and we will be doing some deep dives into car mobility. Tune in to listen to guests like Lindsay Duffield, former president of BMW Canada and JLR Canada, and companies like P3, Relay Cars, and the Connected Vehicle Trade Association. Also contributing some insight into car mobility will be our newly appointed automation reporter, Andy Ace, and a previous guest on the show, Rudy Salo. If you recall, Dennis and Rudy discussed the future of driverless cities, counties, and states. We have lots of great guests and topics coming to you starting this month and into December. So follow along and subscribe to the podcast.
All right. So on the phone here, we have Margaret, 41, from Austin, Texas. Margaret, you're on Wisco Weekly. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you, Dennis?
Very well. Thank you very much. Well, Margaret, what is your question? How can I help you out?
Well, my question is for our, I bought an Audi and I spoke to a good friend who got me a very good deal. And I love my car. My problem is that I went in a couple months ago and I got my 25,000 mile checkup. I had bought the extra package for those checkups and my light was out on the right side. And after I left, it wasn't fixed. So I emailed the service manager that I had spoken to, and he said, come back in. I didn't come back in for, now it's been 4 months, but then both lights were out. So I came back in to get them fixed. And then I was hit with that it wasn't under warranty and other labor costs and whatnot because I hadn't done it. That's basically the problem is I'm trying to see what happened there. Like, can we go back? I had emails. Yeah.
Yeah. So you got, when did you get the car?
I bought the car, I think in July of 16.
July of 16. And was it?
And it's a 15. It's a 15 year. I'm sorry. It's 2015. I bought it after it was like a service car.
Do you recall, was it a certified pre-owned car?
Yes, it was.
Okay, so technically then, if it's a certified pre-owned car and if your headlight is out, or at least both of them are out, and you had sent me some information, too, of a conversation you had with the service advisor team, this should be covered under the warranty, especially if you have
the warranty. The warranty ended in July. So I had gone in May, and it should have been covered, but I didn't go back to actually get it fixed until last weekend, and then the warranty had expired.
Well, double check, because if you indeed have a certified pre-owned car, with Audi, they grant you an additional 2 years and 50,000 miles. So your standard manufacturer warranty is 4 years, 50,000 miles. So let's say presuming the car was sold, it's a 2015 model year, but let's say presuming it was sold in 2014. And if you fast forward, May of 2018 would be the manufacturer warranty expires. But if it's a certified car, then you have two more additional years on that. So you should be good actually till 2020.
Okay. Talk to them about that.
Well, so you could do one of two things. One is if you do have the original documents, on the original documents, it should say whether or not it is a certified used car. And if it is, it should also add a note that you have an extended warranty on the car by virtue of it being certified. If you don't have that handy, then you can certainly call into the dealership and ask, just say, hey, when I bought this car, I believe it was certified. Can you check if it was? You'll want to have your VIN number ready. They'll ask for your VIN, give them your VIN, and they'll be able to tell you. Then based off of that, if it's covered under warranty, this sounds like a manufacturer defect. I mean, usually if it's a burned light bulb, and I think with what you have, I think you have xenon lights. So having it 4 years, 5 years, yeah, that could burn them out, so that should be covered under warranty, and therefore you don't have to pay for anything out of pocket. Or actually, correction. You may have a deductible to pay, which is going to be, I think, like $80, $85, but it's not going to be
$300. I am looking at my folder currently, and it is Audi certified pre-owned. That's on the front of the folder that they gave me. So I know that that is and I have all the Carfax and whatnot.
Boom. There you go.
They did say I didn't hit anything. I was going into my parking garage and I went to park, and there are pillars, obviously, like cement pillars, and there were screws hanging out, like whatever. So I went to park and I parked too close to the screws and it scraped my car.
Okay.
I didn't hit it. I wasn't in an accident. It scraped. I heard it. It happened. They said that popped my light bulb. I will say that did not pop my light bulb. That's not when this happened, but I can never prove it. I don't know. I don't have a date. I can't.
But how does hitting the screws, how does that, so that would have had to damage the housing, the exterior housing, to which upon damaging that, then it would have had to damage the bulb there. I mean, if that is the case, then what's that?
It hit just off the right front tire, and it was all on the body of the car. It didn't infiltrate anything else. It was a scrape, a deep enough scrape for sure, but it didn't. I don't know. They said that it popped the light. I don't think it could have. I don't know how it could have.
Well, then
that was the answer.
Then we are talking about something else here, which, you know, this actually brings up another good point of how when things like this do happen, there is going to be a bit of a negotiation between two parties, uh-huh. right? Because on one hand, you know, they're going to say that the dealership will say that, oh, this is actually due to human factors, which if that is the case, then that is not a manufacturer defect. So if it's not a manufacturer defect, then that will have to come out of the pocket of the customer. And so, you know, this is where you may have to either put up a little bit more of a fight or just have your facts more aligned so that you can argue a case that says that, look, even if there was damage done, this should not have damaged the lights. Like, again, you can see here the housing is still in place. Like there's, I mean, well, you said the other light went out too, right? So both lights have gone out?
The other light went out last Saturday, but it's just at the point of flickering. So when I took it in, it came back on. So it's kind of in an on-off phase right now.
And that's the one that needs to get replaced now?
Well, now it is. That's the left one. That's the new one that I asked them to replace, and they said it's not out. And I said, well, it is out. I was driving with no lights the other night. And they're like, but it's not out now. So they wouldn't replace it. So now I have to go back in to get it replaced.
Okay, so then the light is out now, but this is not the light that was that hit the nails.
No, no, no. That it's the other side.
Okay, so then we're back to.
I think it's just my lights went out. It's been 4 years.
Okay, so. So then if that is the case, which again, that's not out of the ordinary. Xenon lights, they should last a little longer than 4 or 5 years, but you know, again, it depends on use. And so if that is the case, then that will be covered under the certified warranty.
Except the warranty expired in July.
No, but you have a certified warranty. So you get additional years.
On my pre-owned.
Yes. As long as it's a certified pre-owned car, then you get a certified pre-owned warranty with that car.
I have
car.
A certified pre-owned packet.
There you go. It should tell you there then.
I'm sure it does. I'm not going to read it right now while we're online. But
no, that's
I'm
fine.
I'm sure it tells you that somewhere in here.
Well, Margaret, let's do this. Have a look at that information. And I think honestly that if indeed the case is that the light has just gone out, has essentially the bulb is burned out, then that is a manufacturer defect. Your car, being a certified pre-owned car, comes with additional 2 years and 50,000 miles. So then if you were to call up the dealership and say, hey, my light bulb went out and I have a certified pre-owned car, then they will be able to cover the bulb fix under the warranty, and you will only have to pay a deductible. And again, I think the deductible is like $80 or $85, and that's it. That's all you have to pay for.
Well, that would be wonderful, because that's a lot less than I paid.
Excellent. Okay, Margaret, hold on one second here, but thank you for your call.
Thank you so much.
Well, Kelly, this is actually an interesting topic here, and that is of women calling into a dealership and trying to argue a case, because obviously most dealerships are going to be comprised of guys, and there's probably that intimidation factor. But you, as an attorney, you make arguments all the time. And yeah, so, you know, do you have any expertise that you can share with how you formulate an argument? You know, what's your methodology?
I think the biggest factors, one is having your facts straight, knowing ahead of time kind of what happened leading up to whatever caused the problem, what the contract says. So I think the dealership's always going to go back to what is in writing when you bought the car, what promises did they make to you, what is your responsibility with respect to the car, and then trying to come back and in the most honest way possible explain the facts of what led to the issue that would help your case to have the dealership cover the problem. So again, you want to be truthful, but again, knowing up front what the facts are and being prepared for the questions you're likely going to get from the dealership.
Do you ever suggest deploying the pulled over by a cop story where, as a woman, you start to cry and ask for leniency? Don't answer that question. It's okay.
Okay.
Well, listeners, thanks for tuning in to this episode of Wisco Weekly. Stay tuned for more episodes as we talk about car mobility, leading up to Automobility LA and the LA Auto Show. We have more dealer executives that we're bringing to you. We got a lot more stuff going on. Wisco Weekly's taking off. Kelly, what's going on your end?
We're always keeping an eye on tax law changes and how those might affect our clients. But as we talk about the automotive world, we're keeping an eye on Assembly Bill 2107. It's comprised of a few provisions, one of which prohibits automakers from entering the subscription business or transportation as a service model. Another provision deals with the warranty formula for dealers to get reimbursed by the automaker. But just today, California Governor Jerry Brown vetoed this bill. So stay tuned as we explore more about Assembly Bill 2107.
Well, we will have lots to talk about with regards to Assembly Bill 2107. That's actually an interesting one. And there'll be some more franchise talk, franchise legalese. We will speak, Cal. Yes?
Absolutely.
Well, listeners, thanks for tuning in to another episode of Wisco Weekly. As we end every episode, cheers, prost, l'chaim, kipis, nastravi, salud, kampai, mabruk, tutsints to the customer experience.